disruption, innovation. We hear these words all the time, but what do they really mean? Is there a difference between them?
As it turns out, yes, there is. Clayton Christensen, the guy who wrote The Innovator's Dilemma, he warned the tech world about this. Innovation can be a new product or a new way of doing something, but disruption, that's something that totally upends a market.
So innovations can be big, but a lot of them are pretty small. And I'm not trying to discount these smaller innovations in any way, but they're kind of common.
And in a lot of ways, they could still be very helpful. But disruption is different because it's ground shaking. It's transformative.
So if disruption is such a powerful force, if it draws such a clear line of demarcation, that brings us to another question.
Can disruption come from within an industry? And most important, can it come from within healthcare?
I'm Jack Murtha.
And I'm Tom Castles.
And this is Databook. So before we get started, we just want to remind you that if you like this podcast, please rate, subscribe, review, tell a friend.
Yeah, and if you're looking to find us elsewhere, we're all over social media. And of course, this is all driven by our website, Healthcare Analytics News. That's hcanews.com.
So today on Databook, we have a guest. His name is Charles Onger, and he works for Health 2047. And you're going to learn a little bit more about that later.
But before we get to our conversation with Charles, we've got a great story for you guys.
So remember what we were saying about the difference between disruption and innovation, how the two terms kind of get confused? Well, this story definitely straddles that line.
It does. Whether this is a story of innovation or disruption really kind of depends on how you look at it, which piece of the story you consider.
And how much weight you want to give a company that came to market a little late, but whose product landed in a very different way.
So with all that said, we're calling this a story of immense disruption.
If you disagree, yell at us on Twitter.
Yeah, go for it. But maybe wait until you hear exactly how this all unfolds, until you hear just how IBM changed two tech markets, and maybe even the world itself.
It's 1981, the dead of summer in New York City. So the streets are hot, and they're not quite as safe as they are today. But inside the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, it's cozy, it's comfortable, and it's crowded.
IBM, the iconic computer company, is about to become a personal computer company.
So it's rented out a ballroom in the Waldorf, and it is ready to introduce its first ever PC, the 5150 personal computer.
Now let's be very clear about this. This is IBM's first personal computer, but it's certainly not the first personal computer.
Companies like Apple and Atari have already gotten their products to market. Even General Electric and TI, you know, the calculator maker, they've tried their hand at this whole microcomputing thing.
In a very tangible way, IBM's entry into personal computing is meant to ward off outside disruption from garage startups and whoever else.
The New York Times story about the release of this PC names Radio Shack and any number of digital, data, whatever kind of companies as up-and-comers who are nipping at IBM's heels.
But today, August 12th, 1981, changes everything.
It's the day when the king takes the throne.
It's the day when IBM disrupts its own business.
When IBM disrupts how computers are made,
how they're used and viewed,
and how just about everyone thinks of IBM.
For years, IBM had been a business-to-business company. Its computing products were always super high-tech, super high-cost, and super high-impact.
Let's run down the list here. IBM, short for International Business Machines, has had a hand in everything from helping the United States comply with the Social Security Act and hunting down Hitler's cronies to space travel and electronic airline reservation.
This company was changing the way we did business in the 20th century, a time when how we did business was changing more than ever before.
And there was perhaps no greater contribution to the technological evolution of society than the commercial computer system. And that, too, came in large part from IBM.
In the 1950s, it started with the bulky but very rare IBM mainframe.
So in the 1960s, the company began pumping out other kinds of computer systems for businesses and scientific labs, academia, things like that. And these computer systems start taking hold.
Then in 1970, it began selling the next iteration of the IBM mainframe, which totally overtook the computing industry.
All of a sudden, mainframe computers were all the rage for companies and institutions who were doing serious business.
These were the machines that took up entire rooms and required constant air conditioning, and God knows how many support staff members.
You know, they crunched numbers, performed analyses, and provided enough power to support a ton of transactions. These were high-octane, never-before-seen saviors for the organizations that could afford them.
And thanks to IBM, these mainframe computers would dominate the market for the next decade.
Until IBM struck again. So when the Apple II goes live in 1977, it takes off. People are buying these things like crazy. There's even a shortage that might have been intentional on Apple's part.
A couple of years later, the Atari 800 hits the market, and again, bam, wildfire.
Personal computers, microcomputers, whatever the heck you want to call them, they are resonating with the public that have mostly only seen mainframes on TV news reports, or maybe, if they're lucky, on the job.
But it's still not the whole public. These early computers are popular, but they're expensive, and they mostly attract wealthier, tech-centric early adopters.
So these innovations seem like they could eventually become disruptive. Like, they could forever change the computing market and how businesses and everyday people use and think of computers.
Now, during all of this, IBM is watching. It's still making and selling high-tech, high-value products, but IBM leaders know something big is happening.
And they start thinking about getting into the game.
That, however, is not an easy task. IBM is big. It's old, it's rich, it's rigid, it's very bureaucratic. It's kind of set in its ways.
And it's just not built to quickly hop into a new market. But it has a strategy.
IBM has always liked to start smaller companies within the company. As Byte magazine noted back in 1983, these vehicles were the best way IBM had to enter a new market.
So in July 1980, IBM launches the Entry Systems Unit. Its goal? Develop a personal computer.
A competitive personal computer. And the 12-member team has only a year to do this job. In the world of IBM, that's pretty much unheard of, at least back in the 80s.
And beforehand. But even so, the mission is one that IBM decides it cannot complete alone.
So it does something else that is very uncharacteristic of IBM. It uses outside parts.
The PC uses an Intel microprocessor, and it runs on a Microsoft operating system. So IBM also opens the code to third-party developers. It lets them go under the hood to create outside software programs.
This was news. It was very new stuff. Apple actively discouraged outside developers from designing programs for its computers. Computer parts weren't contracted out. This was disruption.
Maybe it was B2B disruption, but it was disruption nonetheless. It was an act of disruption that started within the walls of IBM, affecting its organization, and leaked into the larger computing industry.
Now look at the world. Third-party app sellers are everywhere. Healthcare is one of the few places where proprietary software and closed systems remain so entrenched.
And without IBM's PC, well, maybe the tech landscape would look a little different today.
Who's to say, honestly, but anyway, after a year of long nights and weeks, the Entry Systems Unit finishes the job.
And when IBM introduces its PC in New York City in August 1981, the prices range from around $1,500 to more than $6,000, depending on the specs.
So there it is. The PC is still very expensive, and it's still primarily for tech geeks. But this PC sells like no other ever had.
Sales of the IBM 5150 boom. Rumor has it that customers ordered 40,000 of them on that fateful day in August, just one day.
And this goes on and on, all while those third-party developers start flooding the market with their software programs.
IBM's success inspires clone computers to hit store shelves too. You ever hear of Compaq, maybe Dell?
And because IBM revolutionized the use of outside parts, companies like Intel and Microsoft blasted to prominence.
Anyway, though, these PCs are small. They're somewhat affordable. They're easy to use. They are accessible.
In other words, they're a big departure from the mainframe computers that IBM had placed at the center of its business.
And as time goes on, the adoption rate of the PC skyrockets.
And the mainframe computer gets pushed underground into the server room.
But mostly into the history books.
So, in a very real way, IBM disrupted its own industry.
Its own business. But that was probably going to happen anyway. IBM saw the trouble coming from afar, but still, it got ahead of it. IBM ultimately drove the shift of the computing business.
And it changed how computers are made, how the whole development end of the industry works.
Isn't that what disruption is?
It is, and it says something real about healthcare. Outside tech giants are circling the waters. They're eager to change the way medicine and tech interact. They're buying and innovating their way into the industry.
They're putting great effort into becoming the disruptive force that can change what's wrong with our healthcare system. They're trying to do to healthcare what IBM did to computing.
And interestingly enough, IBM is one of those companies.
But its own past raises a question that not many people in health tech are seriously considering.
Can real, palpable disruption somehow come from within the healthcare establishment? Right now, the prestigious American Medical Association is involved with a project that it hopes will disrupt healthcare. It's called Health 2047, and its job is to transform the industry. Literally. That's from its website. It even calls out the many hopeful innovators who have tried this, and I quote, failed miserably. Health 2047 is a commercial enterprise. It's like an incubator, but it's sort of nestled in the arms of the AMA. So if any disruption does come from this venture, it'd certainly be disruption from within. So anyway, today on Databook, we welcome Charles Onger, Managing Director for Health 2047. Charles, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So Charles, the AMA has been around since 1847, and that's what inspired Health 2047's name. 2047 is going to be the 200th anniversary of the association. So 170 years have gone by since the AMA was founded, and now here we are. Why is it important that these two organizations, the AMA and Health 2047, are connected?
So the AMA looked at about 4 years ago, they did a study around the United States to figure out how transformational change was going to happen in healthcare. And they realized that technology was driving a lot of this transformational change. Dr. Douglas Gibbon, then our CEO, now heading up as managing partner of Health 2047 Capital Partners, and just handed over to Dr. Larry Cohen as CEO. And that was a study done around all the technology and other aspects. And so Dr. Jim Madera, the CEO of the AMA, has been an absolutely transformational leader of sitting there and thinking about how do we do the future of healthcare. And that future of healthcare has been really important. So they came up with this idea of starting this innovation organization and funding it. And that became Health 2047. They looked around the US and found that San Francisco was the place to put it, linking it with all of the technology companies that were available to actually do that transformational change. It's really important to be really close to technology companies and innovators. And bridging that gap was that most important factor for the AMA. And that's why we did what we did. And we, you know, I came on board from Stanford Healthcare and technology arms, and we've got other people from technology places that wanted to make that bridge. You know, from now to 2047, there's going to be a lot of change that needs to happen with the advent of technology the way we're doing it today. I think the biggest thing, Tom, and you did it, there's the outside-in approach and the inside-out approach. And the good old scenario, you don't do technology for the sake of technology. Well, healthcare rapidly adapts all the time in lots of different technology aspects, whether it's, you know, genome therapy or imaging or just basic new drugs. And the difference being is there's a lot of people out there that have connectivity through relationships to the end patient. And that person that's been involved the most, and we do it ourselves every day, is the physician. And physicians have a real amount of in-depth knowledge and expertise that kind of needs to be tapped into, and have those relationships. And it's still in effect today, even since 1847, right? So, you know, you ring up your doctor to try and get help. And so what we found was, how do you bridge that gap? And we talk to all the big technology companies all the time, and they're really interested about the uniqueness that we have of real deep insight that really they can't have access to, or don't have the information that they could go consumer. That's great, but that's only half the story. And you still got to get care, and you still got to get seen, and you still got to get the actual treatment that you need. And physicians are there, and it's not about being a blocker. It's about being an actual adapter for change, and they're very willing to do it. We've done a lot of surveys inside the AMA, and the surveys still keep coming out. It's hard for change, but a lot of physicians and doctors and everybody want technology to actually help them. And they've seen a lot of issues around technology not being implemented in the best ways that actually help them be more efficient, instead of being, you know, today they're not. All the studies that you see just don't deliver the efficiency gains that they want. And they want efficiency, and they want to be able to see patients. And that's what we're trying to bridge that gap with all those technology companies. We've got some great technology partners. We've got some great organizations we're working with. So it's pretty different.
So yeah, Charles, I'm really glad you brought up efficiency, because that is one of the four key areas that Health 2047 is focusing on. How exactly does Health 2047 aim to tackle those pretty massive issues?
So you're absolutely right, Tom. I mean, we've got the four areas that we look at, strategic areas, and we've got everything around data, and that's data liquidity, data rights, interoperability, security of data. And we don't just look at that from inside, like you say, inside out. It's from the physician side. We're looking across the whole aspect of the healthcare industry. And so we spend a lot of time on calls with NIST and HHS and everybody, looking at what security rights might need to happen in data. Because if we can free up the way data works, that'll be a really key transformational change, and requires some leadership in that sector, right? A lot of people talk about liquidity, but it requires a lot of change to happen to free that up. And so if you don't have data liquidity, you can't do productivity change. So without having, and we call it radical productivity, but the radical productivity aspects are, how do I empower machine learning or AI technology that's more than just business intelligence? So this is real analytic technology that goes off and does what we call augmented intelligence. We changed the wording a little bit from AI to augmented intelligence. And that's, how do we augment the healthcare industry with technology gains around AI, and so use the machine learning, use technologies for gathering data in a mobile space, in a regular system, physician and system space, that gives them insights of data and answers and outcomes in real time, or close to real time, when they start to see patients. So that's going to be a real big thing going forward. It's not about anymore them having to do a lot of clicks and think about it. They can have data around Charles Ornger, for instance, before Charles Ornger walks into the exam room. If you look at diabetes, it's just not one aspect. There's many different aspects that you could actually create diabetes and how you manage that. And I've spent a lot of time, I did a case study in Abu Dhabi when I was out there. And this came up massively when I joined Health 2047. You know, 68% of the population in the United Arab Emirates has diabetes. And we were like, how do you change that? And so what we did, And that's why I joined Health 2047, because it was almost the same mission. The Crown Prince put me on a role that said, how do you bring this together? So we took the best healthcare university that we could find in the United Kingdom, Imperial College, and we created a diabetes end-to-end platform. And so if you can free up data, you can free up radical productivity, so the AI technology, which is what we did over there as well, you can get care management. And you can create new ways around chronic care. So in Health 2047, we're looking at how you do that. And then obviously, once you bring those three together, you have a final pillar, which is healthcare value, right? How do you change or capitalize on the revenue streams in different ways.
Now, when I'm walking around the floor of HIMSS, there have to be like several hundred or maybe even 1,000 other ventures that seem to be trying to do the same thing that you're saying that Health 2047 is trying to do. So how would your organization differentiate itself from those other ventures, and what are its unique advantages?
I'm with you. I mean, I've been to HIMSS so many times, and you see 50,000 people and hundreds of stands, right? And so what we're different is we're an innovation arm, and we're a capital investment arm as well that the AMA invested in. So we look at solutions and ideas that might be grown in-house or outside house that we might invest in, as well as the inside house solutions that we spin out. So for instance, we've been heavily looking at how we do blockchain and data networking technology. And I don't know if you saw it, it was an amazing YouTube, you look it up on HIMSS TV, where Dr. Madeira was interviewed, first real big time that he's ever been to HIMSS. And he ended up being on the panel of the AI board and interviewed about what are we doing different in healthcare. And it really blows people away when the head of the AMA turns around and says, yeah, we're looking at blockchain and data connectivity, and we've spun out this new company called Akiri. And the interviewer is just like, but you're not known for that. And that's what we do, Tom. We're so different that we've got real physicians sat in here, and they're not a CMIO that's on the nameplate. These are people that have practiced. These are people that are real doctors. We have Dr. Chris Stock, who was the head of anesthesiology at Northwestern. She advises kids and people going to college about what they should be doing in the future, right? So we're taking all of these aspects around changing healthcare and then even educating people in the AMA about how you do this. And it's massively impactful. You see, you don't just go out and try to create a product and try and sell that this is what we do. We're trying to really create the value streams and talk about the challenges in different ways and positive ways versus negativity. And that creates amazing partnerships and companies. I mean, we did our first company in like 18 months. We spun it out and we've got some announcements coming out of that in the future, and it's pretty amazing, and it takes time and effort and real focus. We're not creating 20 products internally ourselves and trying to create a product company. It's a big difference.
Now, Charles, if you had to point to two or three key pieces of evidence that shows that you're moving toward answers and taking the right step toward those specific areas of improvement, what would they be?
Absolutely. Akiri plays in the data, rights, security, liquidity, data movement, transportation space. We're currently working on one platform around chronic care right now. So we call that first mile care internally. And it's a whole new methodology of working through that. And we're working with real senior level workers within different organizations and agencies in the United States to look at how do we deal with diabetes care and that sort of stuff. So that's the two of those. In AI, right now we're looking at external company solutions and technologies that they're working on. And the AI improvement is, and narrative, to be honest. That's the other thing that we've done with AI is, you know, the AMA is now putting a stance and trying to help with that. And we're spending a lot of time in that space that's helped educate them a little bit around what AI can be and how it should change. And it's not a scary thing to the healthcare industry. And so machine learning, I've spent a lot of time around how do you mix blockchain technologies and machine learning and other things. Been speaking at a lot of conferences, Tulip conference, everything like that, that's around with people like IBM and others that are really, how do we change this on a global scale? So that's, again, another difference. Tech learning that we're doing and making it big. And then on the value payment thing, you know, the AMA operates the CPT coding. How do we get payments faster in different ways to physicians? And some of that plays out in our first mile care piece right now. So it's a work in progress, Tom. It's not something you can do in 5 minutes, and we don't expect to do it in 5 minutes. It's a long-term aspirational goal that why we call Health 24/7 and the AMA's done what it's done. And lots of whiteboarding, lots of techniques, lots of all the good techniques that you find in Silicon Valley mixed with all of the knowledge of some amazing people from marketing and advice and go-to-market that have been industry leaders.
Awesome, Charles. Really appreciate you coming to join us on Databook today. We're so looking forward to seeing what Health 24/7 can do, how it's going to move the ball forward. So we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks again.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
So again, Databook is a healthcare analytics news podcast. We come out every other week. And we cover health tech. We cover the disruption that is gripping the industry. We like to think that we do a good job at it. So please check us out at hcanews.com.
Now, we also depend on you all out there to let us know who is disrupting healthcare. A lot of people claim to have the key to success, but there's also quite a bit of noise and confusion and hype out there. And we want to help you cut through it. So find us on social media. I'm at Castles_Tom on Twitter.
I'm at Jack Murtha.
Tweet at us and let us know.
HCA_news, healthcare analytics news. And we know you like this podcast if you're listening this far into it. So please help us out. Subscribe, rate, review, tell a friend.
So that is it for this episode. I'm Tom Castles.
I'm Jack Murtha.
And we'll see you next time on Databook.